It's really nothing to do back here. I've changed the title a little bit. It's not insects and melodrama, it's full-on insect melodrama. Pathos, Empathy, and Endurance in two films by Fan Scheinberg. And because I work as a film studies person, I'm also going to show, they're very short, but I will screen the films I'm talking about. Because as you'll see, they're quite visceral films, and I think it's important to see them. So I'm sorry for sitting down, by the way, because I'm working on a Mac. The clicker doesn't work, so I hope that's okay. I work at the intersection of film, continental philosophy, and increasingly theology. So my talk is going to be a bit of a mishmash of these three fields. But I think it has a lot of connections to things that we were talking about yesterday, which we were talking about in a different context with a slightly different vocabulary. So hopefully there will be connections and cross-references. Among animals, insects occupy a point far along the spectrum of attention worthiness. Moreover, they elicit a range of largely negative emotions, fear, agitation, disgust, while presumed to have to experience none themselves. I'm interested in thinking through some of the possibilities of cinema as a melodramatic medium that enables us to both feel for insects and in turn witness them feel. And the talk today is part of a longer project that I'm working on cinema, film philosophy, and the mystical philosophical work of Simone Weil, who I also wrote about in my first book. I'm still sort of engaged with her. And I'll talk about her in the latter part of the talk. In 2016, Colin Klein, a philosopher of neuroscience, and Andrew Barron, a neurobiologist, proposed that insects too may be conscious. As a minimal requirement, Klein and Barron claimed, the word conscious refers, and I quote them, refers to a basic capacity to have subjective experience. Animal studies scholars, I think most of us here may be familiar with Thomas Nagel's seminal essay from 1974, What It Is Like to Be a Bat, in which Nagel argues that, quote, the fact an organism has conscious experience at all means basically that there is something it is like to be that organism, end quote. That something it is like to be remains difficult to qualify, though it need not precisely mimic our own mode of self-awareness. Klein and Barron have Nagel in mind when they say that organisms capable of subjective experience do more than merely react. They have a perspective on the world with a unique phenomenological feel. This sort of feel that they're referring to constitutes what they call a minimal level of consciousness, distinct from so-called higher order thoughts that presumably we have, at least some of us, some of the time. Using arguments from comparative functional neurobiology, Klein and Barron argue that insects are likely to possess minimal sentience and do indeed have subjective experience. Contrary to common views of insects as tiny machines or as information interfaces, Klein and Barron believe that insects inhabit a space of their own existence, that there is something it is like to be an insect. They describe this as an insect's, quote, unique, unified perspective on the world. Now, Klein and Barron's work, which was published in 2016 in the journal Animal Sentience, has generated a lively debate among scientists and philosophers about insect and other invertebrates' consciousness, with some animal ethicists expressing concern about what the attribution of sentience to insects would entail for our way of life. Bob Fisher, for instance, believes that the proposition borders on the ridiculous. Taking insects seriously, he warns, leads to what he calls some implausible results. And I'm not sure that the implausibility is to do with the consciousness itself or the results of attributing consciousness. It's not clear to me from Fisher's piece what he means. But he says if insects matter morally and we ought to factor them into our moral deliberations, then we've got some explaining to do. This is Fisher. Fisher worries that even minimal sentience in insects would require radical changes to human practices, from banning all what he calls non-essential driving, because driving kills billions and billions of bugs, to the use of insecticides, or to the allegedly and increasingly popular suggestions to sustainably farm insects for food. And Fisher is a supporter of that idea. So I think as Fisher's list of potential consequences illustrates, the science of animal sentience is generally oriented towards questions that involve instrumentalization and harm. And I think that a lot of our conversations yesterday in various contexts also were kind of limited in a way, or were in the context of some sort of animal use. So animals, the questions of animal emotions pertained or were kind of baked into questions of using animals and how to use them, and questions of using them in a more humane way and so forth. I should add that Klein and Barron do not ask the limited question of whether or not insects feel pain. This is not what their article is about. They're asking about subjective experience more broadly, which is why, to me, their work is kind of more interesting. But the question of pain or suffering is never far off, and it calls for, in the way in which Barron and Klein discussed it calls for empirical proof that would decide it, whether or not insects are sentient and whether or not they feel pain. To put it slightly differently, whatever the ethical implications of the scientific truth about insect sentience, such truth arises within an epistemological framework that generates, but I think crucially also forecloses, certain possibilities of knowledge about insects and our relationship to them. As Dinesh Wadiwal has written in relation to the question of fish sentience, a very similar sort of question, in an article called Do Fish Resist? He's talking about specifically the question of fish experiencing pain, and he says, it is important to consider the epistemological framing here. The fact that fish suffering is in question, do fish suffer, the fact that we need scientists to answer this question before we humans decide to take action, demonstrates a problem of framing, where it is impossible to imagine offering welfare to fish or indeed stop fishing until verification arrives that fish do indeed suffer. Empirical questions about whether or not fish, insects, and other invertebrates experience pain are, of course, totally important and entirely fascinating. There's no doubt about that. But I suppose what Wadiwal and I'm trying to say is that these questions tend to dominate the conversation in ways that limit our capacity to imagine relating to these animals beyond the utilitarian modes of usage, the infliction of harm, and death. And this relates to maybe what you were saying, Tim, yesterday about the problem of suffering. You were talking about it in a different way. You're introducing joy into the conversation. But I will be talking about suffering, but I'm going to try and talk about it in a slightly different register, which isn't limited to do they feel pain, and so what does that do to our using them in some ways. Wadiwal proposes a more radical formulation of the question of animal agency, which needn't be viewed via the narrow lens of feeling pain or even of sentience. In his piece, which is called Do Fish Resist?, resistance replaces sentience as the locus of agency, precisely because resistance, for him, can be located outside of any innate capacity for emotion or action. And the reason is that Wadiwal is using a Foucauldian lens or Foucauldian framework of analysis. And in that, according to Foucault, resistance is the effect of the confluence of forces in which an organism, a fish or an insect, is situated. Thus, for Wadiwal, fish resistance does not depend on the fish's intentional or conscious resistance to humans, but is inscribed onto the fishing apparatus itself, an apparatus designed to overcome the simple fact that fish evade the fishing lines and nets and struggle once caught. So he's looking at the fishing apparatus and he's saying the way the apparatus is designed, the actual technology, is already an inscription of the fact of fish resistance. And it doesn't really matter whether or not fish are thinking, oh, I don't want to get caught. And this again has to do with the Foucauldian framework of analysis that he's using, because for Foucault, basically, as I'm sure many of us know, for Foucault, wherever there is power, there is resistance. So power and resistance are kind of twins, and they cohabit. So intentionality is a kind of different type of understanding of resistance. Wadiwal's novel approach to animal agency is instructive for me. A more expansive approach to insect experience and expression is, I argue, relevant in the films that I'm going to show you. Films which are less concerned with providing visible evidence of an insect's capacity to suffer than with what we might think of more broadly as creaturely pathos. And I'm using the word pathos as a kind of way of edging ever closer to the notion of melodrama. Because, of course, pathos is a component of the melodramatic. By approaching the films as insect melodramas, I'm drawing attention to the role of pathos, and here's the etymology of it, the role of pathos in its myriad meanings, in the colloquial sense of heightened emotion or hysterical, some kind of sentimentalism, in its etymological origins from Greek pathos, or suffering, and in its historical link to tragedy and the workings of fate. Routinely derided as sentimental, excessive, and overly feminized, melodrama has also enjoyed decades of critical attention by literary and film theorists, and I won't go through the entire list, but I'll mention a few of these theorists of melodrama who are relevant also to the study of melodrama and film studies. For my purposes here, I adopt a definition of melodrama as neither a genre nor an aesthetic style, but as what Robert Sinnebrink, film theory and film ethics guy, as what he calls an expressive mode, which is obviously a very capacious definition that allows him to do a lot of things with melodrama. So he calls it an expressive mode. With human protagonists in mind, Linda Williams, another key theorist of screen melodrama, provides a litmus test for the presence of the melodramatic. And she writes, if emotional and moral registers are sounded, if a work invites us to feel sympathy for the virtues of beset victims, if the narrative trajectory is ultimately more concerned with the retrieval and staging of innocence than with psychological causes of motives and actions, then the operative mode is melodrama. Melodrama, especially its pathetic component, opens up an alternative framework for engaging with insects beyond the epistemic confines of investigations into whether or not insects are conscious. The pathetic dimension of melodrama allows us to regard insect life and death as deeply moving and ethically resonant. Indeed, for Robert Sinnebrink, reflecting on melodrama is ultimately an ethical matter, and he asks, and I quote, what is melodrama, or more broadly, the melodramatic imagination? How does this relate to cinema, and in particular, the idea of cinematic ethics? So in what will follow now, I'm going to try and offer a couple of tentative answers to Sinnebrink's questions. Two films by artist and filmmaker Chen Scheinberg, he works in Israel, raise questions about the potential and limits of cinema as an instigator of what Sinnebrink calls ethical experience. Drawing on Giorgio Agamben's writings on gesture, Sinnebrink adopts a gestural rather than pictorial understanding of film. Since gesture implies mediality and communicability, that is, a relation to others, the medium of cinema is ethical, says Sinnebrink, and political. Sinnebrink and Agamben actually argue this. So it's not simply aesthetic, it's not simply about pictures, it's about gestures that attempt to communicate something, and therefore film is inherently ethical and political. Though Agamben and Sinnebrink think of the gesture as typically a human thing, there is, I believe, no reason to exclude animals from the realm of gestural expression. In the first film, which is called After the Locust Attack, made in 2013, and its companion piece from 2016, called Gone with the Wind, not to confuse with the 1939 animal gestures invite a capacious view of cinema as a more than human medium of creaturely and ethical experience. To regard these two works as melodramas might seem odd, yet, as I've already begun to explain, melodrama serves as the nexus for discussing a host of elements that elicit an emotional response to what we see, and also express emotion on the screen. In particular, I'm interested in the connections between pathos, endurance, and empathy that coalesce around this notion of the melodramatic imagination, which is actually taken from some old writing on melodrama by Peter Brooks, called The Melodramatic Imagination, published in 1976. So the films, they're completed 3 years apart, and they feature a single individual, who we see on the screen, a dying solitary locust. Now, I'm using the word locust, not grasshopper, because the films really kind of revolve around the tension between the swarm and the individual, and this is an individual who has lost his or her swarm. So are they a grasshopper, or are they a locust? It's difficult to know what to call this particular individual. The title of the, in Hebrew, the there is only one, oh no, there are actually two words, but they're used interchangeably for locust and grasshopper. So the film's peculiar looking relations between viewer and screen stage an ambivalent encounter with the spectacle of animal vulnerability. I read this encounter through a distinction between empathy and endurance, two modes whose differing orientations, internal and external, and respectively, structure emotions, ethics, and cinematic gaze in subtly but significantly different ways. So a little bit of context on the films. In March 2013, local and international news outlets warned of an imminent locust attack advancing north from Egypt into Israel's southern region. So there's a couple of headlines here. The New York Daily News declared thousands of locusts swarmed over Israel just in time for Passover. And then the Daily Mail, the Daily Mail ran with locust swarm hits Israel as million of insects cross border from Egypt, which I think is a bit more pernicious. So there are kind of political overtones to these headlines, I think. Armed with a camera, Sheinberg traveled from Tel Aviv down to the Negev desert in the hope of capturing these swarms. On arrival, he found nothing, and he drove around asking farmers, have you seen the swarms, have you seen the swarms? Nobody saw it. Eventually, he kind of gave up and then, by sheer chance, came across a single individual, which was wounded, and he filmed it, him or her. So I'm going to show you the film, and the films are not an easy watch necessarily, so I just wanted to give a bit of a content warning. They're very short, but... So this is the first one, after the locust attack, 2013. On the hard asphalt, far from the menaced crops, the locust gazes into the camera. The antennae and mouthpieces and axillary and labial palps gesticulate as if directly at us. The film's two shots, the first in close-up, the second in extreme close-up, are anatomically detailed, the broken wing, the near severing of the head from the thorax, the exposed dorsal artery, the tiny leg hairs, the flecks of dust and sand, render this an image of overbearing physicality and pathos. What can we say about the odd coupling of naturalistic minutiae and the personal address that seems to defy the Levinasian encounter between the self and the human self and an equally human other? How does the film undermine the eco-nationalist iconographies that link locusts to the warring imaginaries of invasion and plague that were evident in the headlines of the newspapers earlier? And what might the film tell us about the cinematic observation of creaturely suffering as a gateway to ethics? Charlotte Slay calls insects zoology's other. Their presence is unnervingly familiar. Their exoskeleton is eerily like ours, but sort of wrongly placed. And Eric Brown explains that insects' alien appearance is really an uncanny resemblance. Arms and legs, but six instead of four. A properly oriented head, but with disproportionate eyes and mouth and ears. And so on. And for Brown, he says, interestingly, that insects embody a sense of excess and loss. It is not the otherness of insects, then, but their position on the edge of strangeness that unsettles. And so, is our response to what we see on the screen, and I'm sure there are many different responses, but one sort of charge that is often, or one proposition that is often suggested, is that our response to the film is anthropomorphic. So is our response to the film simply the kind of result of anthropomorphism? I would suggest not. After the locust attack disavows the temptation to dismiss our response as merely the result of our projection. And I think that's the case because to do so, of course, it's possible to argue that there's nothing there, just reflexes. But to do so, to deny that someone, not something, is present, or alternatively, that something, not nothing, is being expressed, would be to reject the film in its totality. It's possible to do that, but then you're kind of deciding to not watch the film at all, not to engage with the film in any way. Sheinberg endorses what I think of as a naive, in a sense of non-skeptical approach to the possibility of insect subjectivity and emotion, but more so to the fact of insect vulnerability. An empathic, or what Thinnebrink coins a synempathic response, and he thinks of synempathy as fellow feelings or empathy brokered by the technology of cinema. So this kind of empathy is shown to be expansive enough to include even insects in this film, whose sentience is in dispute and whose personhood is difficult to determine. But to my mind, empathy does not fully describe what is happening here, especially the camera's relation and our subsequent response to this green animal. The second film, Gone with the Wind, 2016, whose title clearly references melodrama, cements Sheinberg's observational method as antithetical to empathic investment. Resolute and unflinching, the camera holds its object at a distance, and while something like pathos surely pervades the viewing experience, the film also insists on the impenetrability of the object. So I'll show you the second film, which is briefer, the Gone with the Wind. Okay, sorry, that was a bit loud. In her notebooks, the philosopher and mystic Simone Weil, who was born in 1909 and died in 1943 at the age of 34, makes this shocking, I think, or disturbing statement. She says, "Suffering has no significance. There lies the very essence of its reality. We must love it in its reality, which is absence of significance." Now, there's much to say about Weil's rebuke of the human temptation to imbue suffering with meaning, but I'm concerned today with what the statement reveals about the particularity of observational film. Sheinberg's gaze is probing, unsparing, yet I think non-voyeuristic. That is to say, it finds no meaning and no pleasure in the spectacle of the vulnerable animal. Instead, what I think we have here, which is why it's not strictly empathic, is a form of enduring with, the camera endures with the insect, a steadfastness that confers existence on what we see. Observational cinema frames and holds the subject in its sights, but in not intervening and in the absence of commentary, which is the definition of observational cinema, no voiceover, no explanation, no. So in this lack of intervention, the film lets be the world that it films, affirming its autonomy. Observational cinema is thus marked by an ambivalence of detachment and profound involvement, the contradictory pairing of dispassion and pathos that confirms the real beyond one's subjective projection. Observing vulnerability and suffering in this way, as the unfolding of reality, is concomitant with the mode Weil calls attention. Attention is an orientation that grasps the object while drawing back from it, so it's a sort of impossible orientation. And she says, to draw back before the object we're pursuing, only what is indirect is effective. We do not accomplish anything if we have not drawn back. So what she means by attention is really trying to attend to something, but without making too much of an effort, sort of allowing the object to come to us rather than trying to grasp it kind of aggressively to assimilate it into our own understanding and ways of thinking. And that's what differentiates attention from other forms of concentration that reach out and try to understand something and master the object that we're trying to master. In the domain of cinema, attention means being lost in the act of looking while remaining detached from any personal or societal investment in the object. Sheinberg's films attend to the ordinariness of suffering as an imprint of the real. The camera is witness to the reality of suffering as neither positive nor as negative, but simply as what is. Attentive spectatorship, in turn, grows out of a reckoning with reality, including the contingency of suffering and the vulnerability of all life. Attention, or enduring with, feels different to empathy. It's worth briefly dwelling on the distinction between empathy and endurance as differing modes of relation to the suffering that the camera witnesses. Endurance and empathy appear as two orientations towards other lives, the former external, endurance, the latter, internal. With Laurie Gruman's work on entangled empathy and Elisa Altola's account of the varieties of empathy, Elisa was mentioned yesterday in Tim's talk, so her most recent book is called The Varieties of Empathy. So with Laurie's and Elisa's accounts of empathy as sort of counterpoints, I want to suggest that the look of these films is not strictly empathic, since it does not seek to penetrate or think itself into the place of the insect. As plant philosopher Michael Marder, whose radical thought still awaits due uptake by animal scholars, I think, As Martyr explains, quote, empathy is an attempt to get in touch with the experience of the other qua other, or literally to feel into the other, as the German Einfühlung suggests, Einfühlung in feeling. Thus, Martyr continues, empathy bears upon the other's psychic interiority into which it probes by means of projective imagination. Unlike plants, whose ontological difference from humans and animals, Martyr says, this is him again, illuminates the endemic problems of empathy in other domains of ethics, so he's not a huge fan of empathy. Insects are, as far as we know, liminal beings, just on this side of sentience and subjective experiences, which is what I started with today. If the etymology of empathy implies an inwardness in feeling, the etymology of endurance is equally important. Endure from the late 14th century, to undergo or suffer, also to continue in existence, and make hard, harden, bear, tolerate, keep up, maintain, and in late Latin, to harden the heart against, to be firm, solid, steadfast. Endurance has a temporal dimension, therefore. It emphasizes the undergoing of suffering, the continuation of existence over time. Although Scheinberg's films are short, the first is 3 minutes 30 seconds, the other is just under 1 minute 20, I think they feel really long. They work through duration. In her forthcoming book, Animal Worlds, Film, Philosophy, and Time, Laura McMahon discusses a range of slow animal films, this is her label, that practice what she calls temporal dilation. Temporal dilation, the distending of time, and films that function slowly, she claims that this slowness allows for non-human worlds to unfold. Duration strains our regular viewing habits and acts as an opening unto other, more than human temporalities and their attendant worlds. Duration has a second visceral dimension. Duration stages a prolonged encounter with the dying animals we've just seen, which, unless we avert our eyes, we stay with and endure. This temporal excess is deeply affecting, and it triggers a spectrum of emotions. And again, it could be disgust, it could be pity, it could be fear, it could be curiosity, discomfort, and if we go along with Vey, it could also be love, love for the world. Vey's ethics, I would argue, is one of endurance rather than empathy, since its orientation and its pathos is directed externally. The goal of the attentive staying with is not identification with the suffering individual, but the cultivation of detachment as a means of acknowledging reality, what Vey calls necessity. So this is another key term in her body of thought. So she says, beauty touches us all the more keenly where necessity appears in a most manifest manner. For example, the folds of gravity that impress upon the waves of the sea, or the course of the stars. So, and she includes suffering in as part of necessity. I mean, suffering can be decreed by necessity. It, shit happens, basically, to put it differently. but that, to her, is no reason to deny the world. She wants to kind of cultivate a detached love of the world, and she is also deeply influenced by Buddhism, and so that's kind of where that comes from. It's a sort of strange combination between Christianity and Buddhism. In any case, Scheinberg's films are positioned somewhere between, I think, empathy and endurance. They reflect the dual tendency of cinema to both sort of penetrate and assimilate what cinema captures through projection and anthropomorphism on the one hand, and also to let be, to kind of leave alone the object of sight through this mode that I'm calling attention. Because the films observe both intimately and impersonally, they depart from allegorically charged representations of locus that center on the themes of conflict and threat. So in chapter 10 of the book of Exodus, obviously, locust appears as divine plague, and the book of Exodus says, the east wind brought the locust who, quote, covered the face of the whole earth, so that the land was darkened, and they ate every herb of the land and every fruit of the trees, so there remained nothing green on the trees or on the plants throughout all of the land of Egypt. Images of anonymous swarms persist today in racialized portrayals of migrants and refugees, whose arrival is figured as threatening native ecologies and economies. Such images lend themselves to eco-nationalist divisions between native and invasive, even if the locust, of course, is a native to the Middle East, so it's moving from Egypt into Israel, but it's still native, and yet it's seen and depicted as an invader. In the history of cinema, locust appears most memorably in Terrence Malick's film from 1978, Days of Heaven, which maybe some of you have seen. There's a dramatic standoff between locust and the farmhands in the film, and in this scene, which is an incredibly impressive scene, the farmhands set fire to the fields to get rid of the locust. In Days of Heaven, the cinematic apparatus itself becomes part of the war machine against the locust, even as it utilizes them to produce its grand spectacle. So the actual locusts were used and sacrificed in the making of this film, although not everywhere. So some of these, I think, are they're not real. They're like nails, or I can't remember what he used, but occasionally actual real locusts were used in the making of the film. Scheinberg rejects both the biblical and the kind of cinematic representation of locusts. In place of the swarm, there's an individual, an apparent contradiction, since locust refers to the populous form of grasshoppers. In fact, biological distinctions between locusts and grasshoppers are unstable. Under certain conditions, the gregarious locust has been observed to behave like the solitary grasshopper and vice versa. It's partly a question of density, of population density. Gone with the Wind is set against the east wind of the Book of Exodus, I've just explained, and vis-a-vis the grand Hollywood epic from 1939, from which it sneakily borrows its title. Here, however, in Scheinberg's film, the titular wind is neither the sign nor the agent of a wrathful god, but the workings of Valian necessity, the operation of natural law that blindly throws and thrusts all of God's creatures. For Vay, the wind is a symbol of God's abandonment of the world. So she believes, and there's a long mystical tradition of that, that God created, in order to allow the world to be, God had to abandon it. So kind of like, in a way, the film director who abandons the object that he's filming by not intervening in order to confer existence on it, stepping back, not commenting. God, for Vay, in order to allow the world to properly exist, had to abandon the world. And this act of abandonment has left the world to the powers of necessity or natural law, which is why there's no contradiction between science and religion in Vay. So for Vay, the wind is a symbol of God's abandonment of the world and the operation of natural law. And, it reminds me of this quotation from the Gospel of John, the wind bloweth where it listeth, and thou hearest the sound thereof, but canst not tell whence it cometh and whither it goeth. So is everyone who is born of the Spirit. Interestingly, in the history of cinema, and I'm going to end with a lovely film that isn't difficult to watch, but actually is very joyous. In the history of cinema, the blowing wind has long stood for the presence of precisely this thing, this kind of universal order and natural law, something exterior to human beings and human staging, a force that cinema is apparently uniquely equipped to capture and replay. In 1895, the year that is credited with the inauguration of cinema, in 1895, the early audiences of the Lumiere Brothers' historical Paris screening delighted in moving images that revealed the workings of the natural elements, dust rising from a brick wall, sea waves rocking a boat, and most famously in this film, leaves moving in the wind in the film's Baby's Lunch. So I will show you this under 30-second little film. Thank you. it's a famous anecdote to those who are familiar with film and the history of film, is that the early audiences, what they loved about the film is not the baby. They weren't really interested in the baby. What they were interested in were the leaves moving in the background. You couldn't really see it necessarily because the whole thing is kind of jittery. But there are leaves moving in the background, and I think the reason why people were interested in the leaves rather than the baby was because they had seen human action in the theater, but they've never seen a mechanically reproduced natural movement that had nothing to do with human direction. And so that kind of blew their minds a little bit. And many of the Lumiere films have this sort of movement of natural elements, as I said, dust from a wall that's being broken and dust rises, or a little boat moving on the waves, and the waves of the sea were what people really, really loved. The Wind in the Trees remains a cinematic motif in films to this day, and I can give you a whole list of films that do just that. Even though we're so kind of geared to look at human stories and narratives that we don't necessarily notice these cinematic incidentals of leaves in the wind, but they're still there. And the function of wind in cinema and leaves moving in the wind seems to me unchanged. In other words, it's a marker of natural law and shorthand for cinema's commitment to showing what is, showing of the real. While the forsaken protagonist of Scheinberg's films is no Scarlett O'Hara, this version of Gone with the Wind is its own southern epic. By radically downscaling from human to insect, from nearly 4 hours to under 2 minutes, the film works by way of condensation and parody. Human and insect lives may be irreconcilably different, yet each inhabits the space of its own existence to the same degree. Scheinberg's distressing vignettes function as tiny refutations of human solipsism, not in the name of shared subjectivity, but of shared vulnerability. Moreover, solipsism is overcome not by seeking out a shared meaning of suffering, but precisely through the senselessness of suffering, by which art, and cinema in particular, honor the real. Thanks.
Great. We have...